to Ezekiel and said, "Moreover, thou son of man, take thee one stick and write upon it for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companion. Then take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companion. And join them one to another into one stick, and they shall become one in thine hand."
Welcome to Double Portion Inheritance with Maria Marola, brought to you by DoublePortionInheritance.com. Now, Maria Marola.
Good evening, Mishpachah, friends, family, and Messiah. Tonight is August 7th, 2014. And, you know, back on July 24th, I did a radio program entitled The Fast of the Bridegroom and the Month Elul. And that was part one. I was supposed to do part two last week, but I didn't do it because I was still recovering from laryngitis. So tonight I am continuing part two of The Fast of the Bridegroom and the Month of Elul. And this is taken from my ebook entitled Messiah's 40 Days of Fasting Leading Up to Yom Kippur. Now, before I go on into this teaching, I want to let you know that I offer a flash drive that has 60 of my ebooks on it. Pretty soon that flash drive is going to have 70 ebooks on it. So I will let you know as the count keeps changing. I think at this point there's like 62 ebooks on there. But for a minimum donation of $60 to this ministry, Double Portion Inheritance, just write to me at doubleportioninheritance@gmail.com. And I will send you the flash drive. I now have flash drive bracelets, and the bracelet has the Father's name, Yahuwah, written on it in English and also with ancient paleo pictograph letters. So it's a two-in-one. It's a bracelet, but it's also a flash drive that can hold up to 60 of my ebooks on it. And so that's only like a dollar per ebook. So for a minimum donation of $60 to this ministry, I will send you the flash drive. And on that flash drive will be this teaching entitled Messiah's 40 Days of Fasting Leading Up to Yom Kippur. And that is the basis for tonight's teaching entitled The Fast of the Bridegroom and the Month Elul. Okay, so let's continue with part two of this teaching. The last time we were discussing this subject, which was July 24th, I was talking about the fact that Yahushua, our Messiah, was born on the first of Tishri on Yom Teruah. I know that traditionally it is taught within Hebraic roots circles and Messianic circles that he was born during the Feast of Sukkot. But you see, beloved, I've done about 12 years of research into when was the real Messiah born and why does it matter. And so you can also read that ebook, which will also be included on my flash drive. And it's also available at my website in ebook format for download. It's called When Was the Real Messiah Born and Why Does It Matter? In 1 Corinthians 15:45, the Apostle Shaul or Paul referred to our Messiah as the last Adam. So it makes sense that Yahushua, our Messiah, and Adam were both born on the first of Tishri in the seventh month. In ancient Hebraic thought, it is believed that Adam was created on the first day of the seventh month of Tishri, and the future bride of Messiah will also be born again on the first of Tishri as well, when she puts off the old body of sins in the flesh and she will put on incorruption or immortality, according to 1 Corinthians 15:50 through 53. And so Adam was created on the first day of the seventh month of Tishri. And so it makes sense. It's in keeping with the pattern that Adam was created on the first day of the seventh month of Tishri, Yom Teruah. Our Messiah was born on the first day of the seventh month of Tishri, Yom Teruah, and the future bride of Messiah will be reborn on the first day of the seventh month of Tishri, Yom Teruah. And of course, you know, there's two brides, and I'm going to get into that a little bit more later, but there's two brides that typify Rachel and Leah. Leah was the firstborn, and she goes into the bridegroom's chamber first, and then Rachel, being the secondborn, she goes in last. And I believe that Yom Teruah is the feast where the firstborn bride goes in first, and Yom Kippur is the feast where the younger bride, typified in Rachel, she goes into the bridegroom's chamber last. And I'll get into that a little bit more later. So there's 10 days between these two feasts entitled the 10 Days of Awe. We see a pattern of that in Revelation 3:10, where our Messiah tells the congregation at Smyrna that they would have to suffer tribulation for 10 days. But the congregation at Philadelphia, they have an open door. They go right away into the bridegroom's chamber. And, you know, Rebecca was given the option to stay for 10 more days with her family, but she opted to go and run after the bridegroom, Yitzhak, or Isaac. So once again, we have that pattern of the bridegroom and the bride. The bride is willing to go and run after the bridegroom. This is why the congregation at Philadelphia is ready to go and meet the bridegroom. But the congregation at Smyrna, they have to lag behind for 10 more days, and they don't go into the bridegroom's chamber until they suffer tribulation for 10 days. And then by Yom Kippur, they may be ready to go and meet the bridegroom. Now, here is why this illustration is so significant. You see, in Genesis 24:55, as I've already explained, Rebecca was given the option of remaining for 10 more days with her family, but she did not want to delay, for she was ready to run after the bridegroom. These 10 days symbolize the 10 days of awe leading up to Yom Kippur. Rebecca typifies the bride of Messiah who follows the Lamb wherever he goes. Revelation 14:4. And we read there that the 144,000 are standing on Mount Zion, and they have washed their garments in the blood of the Lamb. They have their Father's name written in their foreheads, and it says they follow the Lamb wherever he goes. In Shir HaShirim, or Song of Solomon 1:4, the bride is ready to run after the bridegroom. It says, "Draw me, we will run after you. The king has brought me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice in you. We will remember your love more than wine. The upright love you." Okay, so why did I go down this rabbit trail to explain all of this when the subject at hand is the fast of the bridegroom? Well, what I'm trying to illustrate is during these 40 days of fasting from the first of Elul leading up to Yom Kippur, Yahushua was fasting for both brides, both houses of Israel. This is why there are twin goats. You see, the first goat is killed, and the blood of that goat is sprinkled on the mercy seat, and the second goat is released into the wilderness. Our Messiah portrayed the role of both goats, the twin goats. When he was baptized or immersed, that was the legal moment of his death. Because in Romans chapter 6, the Apostle Shaul, or Paul, uses baptism as an illustration of death. He says that when we are immersed, we are being immersed into our Messiah's death, burial, and resurrection. So when he was immersed by Yohanan, or John, on the first day of the sixth month of Elul, that was him portraying the pattern of the sacrificial goat. Immediately following his baptism, he was sent by the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, into the wilderness, and that is the scapegoat. You see, the term scapegoat in Hebrew means the innocent party who takes the place of the guilty party. Now, in Hebrew, the word for scapegoat is Azazel, and, you know, in the book of Enoch, it says that there is the name of a demon by the name of Azazel, or a fallen angel. So many people tend to believe that the scapegoat is actually Satan. But beloved, that's not the case. You see, our Messiah portrayed the role of both goats for both houses of Israel. Now, why would he portray the role of Azazel or the scapegoat when Azazel or the scapegoat is the name of a fallen angel? Well, you see, Yahushua came in the likeness of sinful flesh. It says in Romans 8:3. In other words, he came to represent sinful man. He was not a sinner. He was tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. But he had to come and portray the role of the scapegoat to take the place of sinful man. And so you see, at the time of his first coming, the house of Judah or Yehuda, they were still living in the land. They were still in the covenant, and they represent the sacrificial goat that would be killed. And then the other 10 northern tribes, they never returned from the Assyrian captivity. Many of them were still in captivity, and that's why he said, I have come for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He's referring to the 10 northern tribes of Ephraim. And so they represent the scapegoat who were exiled. They were sent away because of their harlotry, because of their pagan idolatry. And so he was portraying both houses of Israel. That is why he had to portray the role of the twin goats. And so this was the purpose of his 40-day fast between the first day of Elul in the Hebrew sixth month leading up to Yom Kippur. By the time he emerged from his 40-day fast on Yom Kippur, he went into the synagogue and he read the Isaiah 61 scroll. Now, in part one of this teaching, I explained why he went into the synagogue and what the purpose was when he read that Isaiah 61 scroll. He was speaking in Yom Kippur language. He first declared the acceptable year. He proclaimed the acceptable year of Yahuwah. That is something that only the Kohen HaGadol, the high priest, was allowed to do. He was revealing that he was the new high priest that year, Melchizedek, that he was now restoring the role of the high priest back to Melchizedek. Okay, so now I want to talk about the seven-year ministry of Jacob for his bride Rachel, and also our Messiah's seven-year ministry for his two brides, Rachel and Leah. You see, the three spring feasts represent the first fruits of the barley harvest of souls for Old Covenant Israel. You see, all those who were righteous under the Mosaic Covenant, but they did not have the blood atonement of Messiah, were redeemed when Yahushua went into the lowest parts of the earth and he redeemed these first fruits of men's souls from Abraham's bosom. At this time, he also presented them before the Father in heaven at the throne. Now, we read about Abraham's bosom in Luke 16, and he went into the lowest parts of the earth to redeem those who were in that holding place, as we read in Ephesians 4. Now, Jacob worked for 7 years for Rachel, but he was tricked into marrying Leah. Leah symbolizes the 10 northern tribes of the house of Israel, and they were scattered to the Gentile nations. They were divorced, and they were later called Gentiles, no longer my people, as we read in the book of Hosea. Yahushua Messiah came for the house of Yehuda or Judah, typified in Rachel, but his gospel was rejected by them, and his gospel was sent to the nations. Jacob was then married to Rachel, typified in the house of Judah, after he finished the week with Leah. This means that during the 10 days of all, there will be a literal 7-day wedding between Yahushua Messiah and his bride. His bride are all the born-again believers from both the house of Judah and the house of Ephraim, and they typify Leah, as these are the firstborn sons, and they are typified in Ephraim. Ephraim is called my firstborn son in Jeremiah 31, verse 9. Now, you may be asking yourself, wait a minute, Leah did not give birth to Ephraim, but he was the grandson of Rachel. So why are you assimilating Leah to the 10 northern tribes headed by Ephraim? Well, the answer to that question will take a little bit of explaining, so pay close attention. First of all, the name Leah Jacob's first wife has multiple meanings. Her name means weak-eyed, but it also means cow. Leah represents the 10 sons of Jacob or Jacob, who were later scattered to the nations under the tribal name of Ephraim. Ephraim is likened unto a heifer or a cow in Hosea 10:11. Leah had 10 sons, to include those by her handmaidens, Bilhah, and also Zilpah, Rachel's handmaiden Bilhah, and her handmaiden Zilpah. And so her children are the 10 northern tribes. The name Rachel means lamb, and she had 2 sons, Benjamin and Joseph, who ended up becoming the 2 southern tribes. In 1 Kings 12, under the leadership of the king of Judah, Rehoboam. Now, another reason why Leah symbolizes the 10 sons of Jacob or Jacob, to include those born by Zilpah and Bilhah, is because out of Jacob's 12 sons, Judah was the one who offered to give his life as a ransom for the life of Benjamin and Joseph. And you see, Joseph sent his brothers back home without Benjamin, as we read in Genesis 43:8, and Judah vowed to become surety for Benjamin forever, to be his keeper, as we read in Genesis 43:9. This is why Judah and Benjamin have remained together as Rachel's children of the 2 southern tribes of Judah. Judah and Benjamin were both instrumental in bringing about restoration between Joseph and the other sons of Jacob. Rachel's 2 sons, Benjamin and Joseph, were both helped by Leah's 4th son, Judah. And this is why Judah has joined himself to Rachel's 2 sons forever. This is also why the house of Judah typifies Rachel to this day. It is because the 2 families end up switching places in the last days. Judah becomes more like Ephraim, the prodigal son, in the last days, but he returns home. And Ephraim begins to obey the Torah just like Judah, and so the first becomes the last, and the last becomes the first. Another reason why we can assimilate Rachel to the house of Judah is because her body was buried in Bethlehem, Judah, as we read in Genesis 35:19. Later on, the prophecy of Jeremiah came to pass when King Herod killed all the baby boys of the house of Judah, 2 years old and under, as we read in Matthew 2:15-16 and Jeremiah 31:15. And Rachel's children are referred to as those of the house of Judah. Let's read it in Yirmiyahu or Jeremiah 31:15. It says, "Thus says Yahuwah, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel, weeping for her children, refused to be comforted for her children because they were not." That same prophecy is repeated again in Matityahu or Matthew 2, verse 16 and 18. I'm going to read it. "Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was exceeding wroth and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem and on all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Yirmiyahu, or Jeremiah the prophet, saying, in Ramah was there a voice heard, lamentation and weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and would not be comforted because they are not." You see, Rachel's children are those of Bethlehem, Judah, while the house of Ephraim are Leah's children. If Ephraim is the grandson of Rachel, then why is he assimilated to Leah? Did you ever notice that Leah was buried with Jacob, but Rachel was not? Here we read that Jacob was buried with his wife Leah first. Let's read it in Bereshit or Genesis 49:31. It says, "They buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife, and there I buried Leah." Now this is obviously talking about Jacob or Jacob, and he's saying that he buried Leah there next to where he would be buried later. And what does this tell us about Leah? Well, pay attention to this because you're going to see that those who are buried in baptism are the true bride of Messiah. In Romans 6:3-4, it says, "Know you not that so many of us were immersed or baptized into Yahushua Mashiach, were immersed into his death? Therefore, we are buried with him by immersion into death, that like as Mashiach was raised up from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. For if we have been planted together in the likeness of his death, we shall also be in the likeness of his resurrection. Now, are you getting the picture yet? Those who are buried in baptism with Messiah are the true bride. Leah represents the firstborn from among the dead because she was buried with Jacob, just like the bride of Messiah is buried in baptism with her bridegroom. Leah represents the born-again bride who will be caught up to meet the bridegroom first on the Feast of Trumpets, Yom Teruah. For Leah was married first, and she was also the firstborn daughter of Laban. But then 7 days later, her sister Rachel was also married to the bridegroom. And thus we can see that within these 40 days, starting with Messiah's baptism on the first of Elul, within these 40 days, he fasted for both brides, both houses of Israel, typified in Leah and Rachel. And so, on the Feast of Trumpets, the first of Tishri, the first day of the seventh Hebrew month, called Yom Teruah, that is when he is going to call up the first bride, typified in Leah. As we read in 1 Thessalonians 4:17, it says that we shall all be caught up to meet him in the air. And I believe that that bride goes into the bridegroom's chamber immediately following a 3.5-year tribulation. There's no such thing as a pre-tribulation rapture, beloved. The bride must go through tribulation, 3.5 years. At the end of that 3.5-year tribulation, that first bride typified in Leah, the born-again believers, they will go into the bridegroom's chamber, the chuppah, and I believe that will be in the new Jerusalem, the new Yerushalayim. Okay, as we read this in Revelation chapter 14, that the bride is standing on Mount Zion with the Lamb. Then, after a 7-day honeymoon in the chuppah, the bride that typifies Leah, she comes back with Mashiach. As we read in Revelation 19, the bride that follows him, the army that followed him, is clothed in white linen, fine and clean. And then he comes back for the other bride typified in Rachel. And I believe that that will be the house of Judah. Those who are living in Jerusalem at the time, who maybe did not know that he was their Messiah, but they obeyed the Torah. They didn't take the mark of the beast. They didn't follow the anti-Messiah. And so they were sealed in advance. And so it says in Zechariah 12:10, they will look upon me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for his only son. And so I believe that is the other bride that typifies Rachel from the house of Judah. They will be married to the bridegroom on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And that is when he will take vengeance on all the enemies of his bride. So it will be the Day of Vengeance. We're going to take a short commercial break, and we'll be right back after this message. Hi, this is Maria Marola from Double Portion Inheritance Ministries. I would like to invite you to join me for the Bridegroom's Chamber Prophetic Conference in Allentown, Pennsylvania, coming up this August 27th through the 29th. Why are we calling this conference the Bridegroom's Chamber? Well, we are now in a prophetic time in history when the Bride of Messiah is being prepared to meet her Bridegroom, the Messiah of Israel. Like Esther, who prepared herself for 6 months with oil of myrrh and another 6 months with sweet odors, the bride must be cleansed and purified before she can come face to face with her bridegroom. The prophet Yoel, or Joel, foretold of this time in history in Joel 2:16, "Gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children, and those that suck the breast. Let the bridegroom go forth of his chamber, and the bride out of her closet." To register for the Bridegroom's Chamber Prophetic Conference, go to thebridegroomschamber.com. Hope to see you there. Hi, this is Maria Marola from Double Portion Inheritance Ministries. I would like to invite you to join me for the Bridegroom's Chamber Prophetic Conference in Allentown, Pennsylvania, coming up this August 27th through the 29th. Why are we calling this conference the Bridegroom's Chamber? Well, we are now in a prophetic time in history when the Bride of Messiah Messiah is being prepared to meet her bridegroom, the Messiah of Israel. Like Esther, who prepared herself for 6 months with oil of myrrh and another 6 months with sweet odors, the bride must be cleansed and purified before she can come face to face with her bridegroom. The prophet Yoel, or Joel, foretold of this time in history in Joel 2:16, "Gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children, and those that suck the breasts. Let the bridegroom go forth of his chamber, and the bride out of her closet." To register for the Bridegroom's Chamber Prophetic Conference, go to thebridegroomschamber.com. Hope to see you there. Okay, so now I want to talk about the seven feasts. Let's go through them all. The first one is Passover. In Hebrew is Pesach. Okay, Pesach, and the prophetic significance, Messiah's death as the Passover lamb for the firstborn, and his death as the red heifer for the prodigal son, Ephraim. He symbolizes the younger son in the parable of the prodigal son in Luke 15. Now, at Messiah's first coming, the younger son symbolized the 10 northern tribes of the house of Ephraim, the younger son. But at his second coming, the younger son in that parable symbolizes the house of Judah, because at his first coming, it was the 10 northern tribes. They were in exile. They were not obeying the Torah. And so he had to die for them. He had to redeem them. And now at his second coming, it is the house of Judah, who largely are in unbelief. Most of them do not accept Yahushua as the Messiah. And so the story of the prodigal son typifies both houses. When the younger son returned home, the father killed the fatted calf. That's symbolic of the red heifer. We read that in Luke 15:23. Now, what is the red heifer? Well, you see in Numbers 19, it talks about when the altar in the temple becomes defiled, the priests had to escort the red heifer outside of the city limits of Jerusalem, outside the camp, and they had to kill the red heifer, and they used the ashes of the red heifer to cleanse the articles of the temple. And so the Passover lamb was killed for the house of Judah, the older son, the firstborn. And then the red heifer was killed for the younger son, the prodigal son. That's why in the parable of the prodigal son, when the prodigal came home, the father killed what? A fatted calf. He didn't kill a lamb. He killed the red heifer, because the red heifer is what sanctifies the altar. And so when the younger son received this blood atonement for his sins, he was then advanced to the status of the firstborn when he became born again of incorruptible seed, according to 1 Peter 1:23. You see, Ephraim was the youngest grandson of Jacob, and yet in Jeremiah 31:9, we read that he becomes the firstborn. So the house of Ephraim are the 10 northern tribes of Israel. They were scattered to the four corners of the earth. They became known as Gentiles, no longer my people, as we read in Hosea, Lo Ami. But in the last days, the house of Ephraim, they become the fullness of the Gentiles. They become a multitude of nations. And what happens? Many of them become born again by the blood of Messiah. And that's how they ended up becoming the firstborn. That's how the house of Ephraim became the firstborn. That's why Jacob, or Jacob, when he crossed his hands, he placed his right hand on the head of Ephraim, the younger son, and he placed his left hand on the head of Manasseh, who was the older son. And the first shall be last, and the last shall be first. So at the Passover, Messiah not only fulfilled the pattern of the Passover lamb, but he also left the camp and became the red heifer. He became the red heifer for the house of Ephraim, those who were in exile, those who were afar off. And now, the next day we have, on the 15th day of the first Hebrew month of Abib, we have the Feast of Unleavened Bread called Chag Matzah. This is Messiah's burial. You see, Leah, the first wife of Jacob, she was buried with Jacob, as I already said, but Rachel was not. We read that in Genesis 49:31. This means that only those who are willing to die to their old nature with Messiah in burial, in other words, in baptism, they will be raised to new life. And so Leah typifies the bride that gets caught up to meet him in the air on Yom Teruah, the Feast of Trumpets, and Rachel typifies the bride that she becomes born again at a later time, 10 days later, on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement. And you see, on Yom Kippur is when he's going to make both brides one bride, one stick in his hand. And then finally on the Feast of Tabernacles, both brides, they're going to be one bride. They're going to be considered one bride at that point. And they're going to go into the Feast of Tabernacles with the bridegroom to celebrate the wedding reception with the guests. Okay, so let's go on to the next feast, the third feast, symbolizing the third branch on the menorah, is called First Fruits. In Hebrew, it's Yom HaBikurim. Yom HaBikurim. It's the Day of First Fruits. This is Messiah's resurrection and his first fruits offering for the righteous souls who died under the Mosaic covenant, and they are typified in the spring barley harvest. You see, the high priest had to go into the temple, and he had to wave the first sheaf of the barley harvest before Yahuwah in the temple on first fruits. Well, Yahushua did the very same thing. We read about this in Ephesians 4. He went into the lowest parts of the earth, and he redeemed all those souls who were in Abraham's bosom. We read about Abraham's bosom in Luke chapter 16. And what did he do? He redeemed all those who were righteous. They were obedient, but they didn't have a permanent blood atonement. So he went into the lowest parts and he redeemed them. They were his first fruits offering. Okay, and then the fourth branch on the menorah is the middle branch. It symbolizes the servant candle, which is Messiah. And that fourth feast correlates to the fourth branch. It's Shavuot in Hebrew. In Greek, it's Pentecost. This fourth feast brings together all those who were redeemed under both covenants, the Mosaic covenant and Messiah's renewed covenant. In other words, both brides, Leah and Rachel, they both come together in the middle, and the middle branch on the menorah represents the middle feast, and this represents Messiah who brings together both houses of Israel and both covenants. Yahushua, Messiah, came to us in the fourth millennium at his first coming. And he also comes from the tribe of Judah. Judah is the fourth son born to Leah. And he represents the door to the Father. The fourth letter in the Hebrew alphabet is called the Dalet. And he is the door. The door means the Dalet. And so in the Father's name, we have Yehuda. We have five Hebrew letters. Yod, He, Wa, Dalet, He. Five letters. But the fourth letter is the Dalet, the door. So in the Father's name, we have embedded the door. The door, or the Dalet, is embedded in the name Judah or Yehuda. You see, and finally, Messiah died on the fourth day of the week, which is in the midst of the week. Not only did he die in the midst of the week, according to Daniel 9:27, not only was this the midst of the literal week, the fourth day of the week we commonly know as Wednesday, but he also died in the middle of the 7 years. You see, just like Jacob or Jacob, he had a 7-year ministry where he worked for Rachel. He agreed to work for Rachel for 7 years. At the end of those 7 years, he was tricked into marrying Leah. Then Laban said he could marry Rachel at the end of the week, the literal week, the 7-day week with Leah. But he still agreed to work yet another 7 years for Rachel after that. So he worked for a total of 14 years for both of his brides. However, Messiah's ministry was cut in half. You see, his total ministry was supposed to be 7 years, but it was cut in half. That's why in Daniel's prophecy, it says in the midst of the week, it says he was cut off. Okay, he was cut off in the midst of the week. In other words, he was supposed to fulfill the 7 years, but he was cut off in the midst of the week. So he had a 3.5-year ministry at his first coming, and then he was cut off. And then the two witnesses pick up where he left off. The two witnesses, they become the one new man. They are the two houses of Israel, the house of Judah and the house of Ephraim, all those that are born again from those two houses, and the overcoming assemblies of Smyrna and Philadelphia, the Gentile companions who follow them. That's who the two witnesses are. The two witnesses are. The angel told Yehuchanan, or John, he says that the two witnesses are two olive trees and two candlesticks. So the two olive trees are both houses of Israel, and the two candlesticks are the two overcoming assemblies of Smyrna and Philadelphia. So when before Messiah returns, the two witnesses are going to fulfill the last 3.5 years of his 7-year ministry. They're going to finish where he left off. And so they're going to finish out the week. They're going to finish Daniel's 70th week for Yahushua. And this is the group that's called, they are the one new man. They are the man child spoken of in Revelation chapter 12. They are going to do the greater works than even he has done. And after the 7-year period is finished, okay, they're going to resurrect at the end of the 3.5 years. Messiah also resurrected at the end of the 7th day of the week, Sabbath. This represents his second coming. And this will represent the last feast of the sacred year, which is the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, some of you may be saying, well, I've heard other Hebraic teachers and Messianic teachers say that Messiah only had a 70-week ministry. Well, I've heard that theory also. However, I do not agree with that theory. I was shown a revelation about this because I pondered this for a while and I thought, well, why is it that Jacob had two periods of 7 years back to back for both brides? And why is it that Joseph, his son, had two periods of 7 years back to back, 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine? But why is it that Messiah has two periods of 3.5 years? His literal ministry on earth was 3.5 years, and then his two witnesses fulfill the 3.5 years. So why was it cut in half? And as soon as I pondered the question, it was like the Ruach, or the Holy Spirit, just said to me, let's take a look at Solomon when he was about to cut that baby in half. And then it dawned on me. I understood exactly why. You see, King Solomon was presented with these two harlots. These two harlots came to him. Both of these harlots typify the house of Judah and the house of Israel. We read about this in Jeremiah chapter 3. In Jeremiah chapter 3, it speaks of two harlots, and one is Samaria and one is Judah. Well, both of these harlots gave birth to a son. You see, in ancient times, women could not inherit land on their own. They needed a male heir. And so each of these women gave birth to an heir, a male heir. However, the one woman accidentally suffocated her child in the middle of the night by sleeping on him. So what does she do? She takes the dead baby and places the dead baby in the arms of the woman who's sleeping, and she steals her living child and she passes it off as her own. Now, when both women woke up, there was a dispute among them. So they went to King Solomon, and he knew exactly how to solve the problem. He said, let's take the baby and cut the baby in half with a sword. And of course, the real mother that had compassion on her child said, no, please don't cut the baby in half. Let the baby live. Give the baby to the other woman. So she was willing to give up her child so that the baby could live. And that's how Solomon knew who the real mother was. The other woman was just being selfish. She didn't care about the infant. All she cared about was her own inheritance. A male heir meant that she could have her inheritance. So these two harlots symbolize both houses of Israel. And so the Feast of Pentecost, the fourth feast, or Shavuot, the fourth feast, or the represents the fourth branch on the menorah. This feast brings both houses together. It brings both of these harlots together. They stop fighting. You see, when Solomon was about to take a sword, what does the sword represent? The sword of the Spirit, the Word, right? Out of his mouth goes a two-edged sword. What is the two-edged sword? The two-edged sword are two different concepts. We have wisdom and we have revelation. Two concepts that form a balance of one concept. We need both. We need both wisdom from Torah and we need revelation from the Ruach or the Holy Spirit. What are some other illustrations we can glean from the two-edged sword? How about wise as a serpent and gentle as a dove? You see, the Torah makes us wise as a serpent, but the Ruach, the Holy Spirit, makes us gentle as a dove. And so out of his mouth goes a two-edged sword. What does that two-edged sword symbolize? It symbolizes mercy and judgment. You see, the Torah brings judgment when we don't obey it, but Yahushua brought mercy. So we need both judgment and mercy. That's the two-edged sword. The two-edged sword symbolizes both houses of Israel. You see, at different times in history, each house of Israel had been sent into exile. And each time one of these houses was sent into exile, they had to experience humiliation. They had to be humbled. And then when the house of Judah returned back to the land after the Babylonian captivity, they wouldn't let the other houses come back. They wouldn't let the other 10 tribes come back. They were not holding the same standard for the other 10 tribes as they did for themselves. And so what does Messiah do? Just like in the days of King Solomon, he says, okay, you're going to fight over this inheritance? I'll tell you what, I'm going to cut the baby in half. I'm going to cut your inheritance in half, and nobody's going to have a living child. Nobody's going to have a living heir. Nobody's going to have the Messiah. And so when the true mother, the one who had compassion for the child, realized that her child would be dead, she said, give the heir to the other woman. And so the true mother is the one who cares for the child, not the one who only cares about her own selfish needs, meaning her inheritance. And so this is how we know for certain that Messiah had a 3.5-year ministry at his first coming, and the two witnesses finished the 3.5 years just before his second coming. So you see, his ministry was typified in Jacob's ministry for Rachel, but it was cut in half. Why was it cut in half? Because both houses of Israel were divided. In 1 Kings chapter 12, they were divided after King Jeroboam and Rehoboam split. They took both kingdoms to their own domain, and therefore they became two separate nations, two separate kingdoms. Okay, so let's talk about the three fall feasts, which represent the latter rain harvest of the wheat, which symbolizes the redeemed souls under the renewed covenant. Okay, the fifth feast is called the Feast of Trumpets, or Yom Teruah. You see, the number 5 symbolizes Torah. This is the feast where the renewed covenant believers are typified in Leah, the 10 northern tribes of Ephraim. They are redeemed. They symbolize all those who were born again among the Gentile nations. They symbolize the bullock, the red heifer. These are redeemed at the sound of the last trumpet on this particular feast. Now, there are 4 different trumpet sounds on the Feast of Trumpets. And the number 4 represents the 4 angels from the 4 winds of heaven who gather the elect from the 4 corners of the earth. These 4 types of trumpet blasts are as follows. We have the first trumpet, which is called the tekiah. It is a pure, unbroken sound that calls man to search his heart, to forsake his wrong ways, and seek forgiveness through repentance. Then we have the second trumpet called the shebarim. It's a broken staccato, a trembling sound. It typifies the sorrow that comes to man when he realizes his misconduct and he desires to change his ways. It sounds like a man moaning in repentance. Then we have the third trumpet, the teruah. It's a wave-like sound of alarm calling upon man to stand by the banner of Elohim. And then finally, the fourth trumpet, which is the last trump, the tekiah gedolah, the prolonged and broken sound typifying a final appeal to sincere repentance and atonement. The fourth trumpet is the last trumpet sound that is made during the Feast of Trumpets, and this represents the 4 angels from the 4 winds of heaven who gather the elect from the 4 corners of the earth. We read about this in Matthew 24:29 through 31. And then the sixth feast is known as Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. This is the sixth feast of the year, and it represents the redemption of mankind because Adam was created on day number six of creation. This will be the day when the remnant from the house of Yehuda or Judah are sealed, according to Ezekiel 9 and Revelation chapter 7. They will finally see their Messiah face to face. This will happen at the Jubilee in the last 50th year as the redemption for the house of Yehuda. This is when Yehoshua will also be married to the other bride, typified in Rachel, from the house of Judah, and they will finally accept him as their Mashiach. And then finally, the seventh feast is known as Sukkot, or the Feast of Tabernacles. This feast will begin the ingathering of both houses of Israel, as Messiah will make them both as one stick in the hand of Yahuwah. We read this prophecy in Ezekiel 37, 16 through 17. And so that takes them into the millennial kingdom, the Sabbath millennium. This will last for 1,000 years. And we read in 2 Peter or 2 Kefa chapter 3, 8, one day is like 1,000 years to Yahuwah. So while the Feast of Trumpets takes place at the civil new year, because it commences at the time of creation, when linear time itself began, it can be seen as the anniversary of time. Yahuwah's physical creation of man began on the first of Tishri in the seventh month with Adam, but mankind's spiritual redemption began in the first month of Abib when Yahuwah brought Israel out of Egypt. And so you see, the first day of the seventh month is when we are physically born, and the first day of the first month is when we are born spiritually. That's why both calendars come together in the seventh month of Tishri. You see, we have the one calendar, the civil calendar that measures linear time, lasts for a total of 12 months. And we know this because in the Torah, it tells us in Vayikra or Leviticus 25:9, it says, "Then shall you cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month in the Day of Atonement, shall you make the trumpet sound throughout all your land." And so this measures linear time because every year on Yom Kippur is a 7-year, we measure the 7-year Shemitah, called the sabbatical years. In Hebrew, it's called the Shemitah. And every 50th year, we measure the Jubilees. And so this goes from Yom Kippur to Yom Kippur. In Vayikra, or Leviticus 25:10, it says, "And you shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land. Unto all the inhabitants thereof, it shall be a Jubilee unto you, and you shall return every man unto his possession, and you shall return every man unto his family." And so the civil calendar lasts for 12 months. And then the sacred calendar, which begins in the month of Abib, that lasts for only 7 months. It measures the 3 agricultural periods, which is the barley harvest, the first wheat harvest, and the second wheat harvest in the end times in the 7th month. It's the latter rain harvest. And so the 7-month calendar begins with Abib and it ends with Tishri, and it measures the 7 feasts. And that's why there are 2 different calendars, and that's why there's so much confusion between the traditional Jewish understanding of the Rosh Hashanah being in the first day of the 7th month of Tishri. And then in the Hebraic roots community, we recognize that the first day of the year is in the month Abib. But ideally, we must understand that both houses see something that the other doesn't see. And so now we understand that the civil calendar begins on the first day of the 7th month of Tishri. This is when creation itself began. This is when Adam was created. This is when Messiah was born on the first day of the 7th month of Tishri. And this is when the born-again bride will be born again into immortality. And then the sacred calendar was instituted at the Exodus in chapter 12, when Yahuwah brought Israel out of Egypt. That's when he instituted a second calendar called the sacred calendar, which measures the 7 feasts, and it also measures the 3 harvest periods in Israel. Okay, so we are out of time. Shalom until next time.
We hope you enjoyed today's broadcast and that you are encouraged in your walk with Messiah through the teaching. To visit Maria's website, visit DoublePortionInheritance.com. That's www.DoublePortionInheritance.com. This broadcast depends on the love gifts and offerings of listeners like you. To send a donation to Maria's ministry, write Double Portion Inheritance, Maria Merola, P.O. Box 7311, Fredericksburg, Virginia, 22404. Or you can donate with the PayPal button at DoublePortionInheritance.com. For Maria and all the ministry team at Double Portion Inheritance, may Yah bless you.